Welcome to this podcast. I am Philip Andrew Speed at the Energy Studies Institute of the National University of Singapore, and I'm going to examine the role of national culture in public policy, drawing on my recent paper in the Energy Journal. In my application of institutionalism to the energy transition, I have frequently referred to the diagram in Oliver Williamson's 2000 paper in the Journal of Economic Literature. There he identified three levels of institution. First, the institutions that directly govern transactions and prices. Above that, the institutional environment, which comprises the general features of the political, economic, and legal systems. And then at the top, he placed the embedded institutions of beliefs, norms, values, etc. In other words, culture. Most of my research has focused on the institutional environment, with only occasional forays into culture. But the COVID lockdown in 2020 gave me the opportunity to pull together different strands of thought that I had been dabbling in for a few years. These are the scientific evidence for cognitive differences between societies, the historical evidence for differences in scientific philosophy, and the historical evidence for contrasting political, economic, and legal cultures. But before I address each of these in turn, you might well ask, what is it in energy policy design and implementation in China that makes it worth looking at culture? For me, these features included, first, the lack of an overriding conceptual framework for policy design, such as the market, but rather a preference for incremental pragmatic solutions to policy challenges. Second, the ambiguity of and frequent contradictions within many policies. Third, the enthusiastic deployment of high-level slogans. And finally, the continued reliance on administrative instruments rather than market forces or legal processes. Now, none of these features by themselves are unique to China, but collectively they are distinct in some ways. So let us go back to these three strands of thinking that I have been pursuing over the recent years. The first concerns the scientific evidence for cognitive differences between Western and Asian societies. One of the pioneers in this field was Richard E. Nisbet at the University of Michigan, beginning in the 1990s. He and colleagues conducted psychology experiments on students from different cultural backgrounds. Continuing research by Nisbet and by others steadily boosted the credibility of their findings. Drawing on parallel research on culture, a number of conclusions could be drawn. First, concerning culture in general, culture, including language, affects cognition in two main ways. First, relating to perception and categorization, and second, relating to explanatory frameworks and problem solving. Secondly, culture, along with training, expertise, and life experience, is one of the factors affecting reasoning and causal explanation. And of course, this is all related to public policy. More specifically, when it comes to West and East, societies with a Western cultural heritage are more likely to focus on individual actors or factors, to apply formal logic to solve problems, and to display a strong tendency to distinguish between right and wrong solutions to problems. In contrast, other societies, such as China's, may apply more intuitive and holistic thinking. They're more likely to assess the wider context and, importantly, accept contradiction and ambiguity. Moreover, neuroscience studies have confirmed that the brains of individuals from different cultures, say West and East, often operate differently, even in some cases to produce the same solution to a problem. There is also evidence from the field of epigenetics that such cultural differences may be transmitted between generations. Thus, it is reasonable to deduce that policy elites from different cultures may analyze policy problems and design policy solutions in different ways, regardless of their specific political leanings, left or right. The caveats that apply to all these generalizations are twofold. First, that they have greater explanatory power at the group or societal level than at individual level. And secondly, that when an individual moves from one culture to another, they are likely to adopt features of the new culture, especially if they are relatively young when they move. So let's move on to the second line of thinking, and that is the historical evidence for differences in scientific philosophy between West and East. At the same time as pursuing the above line of inquiry, I was delving into the history of China's scientific development. The Western pioneer in this case was Joseph Needham of the University of Cambridge. He was already an eminent biochemist when he was sent to China in 1942 to assist Chinese scientists with supplies for their research. This Needham did, but he also became intrigued by evidence of the country's long history of scientific and technological endeavour, and he began a collection of documents that ended up being the foundation for the Needham Research Institute at Cambridge, as well as the basis for his multi-volume endeavour, Science and Civilization in China. The research of Needham and his colleagues revealed not just the long heritage of science in China, but also that it had distinctive characteristics. His successor in this field of research was Geoffrey Lloyd, a scholar of both ancient Greek and ancient Chinese thought, also at Cambridge. His comparative research successfully drew out the contrasting metaphysical outlooks of these two societies. In simple terms, these can be summarized thus. The Greeks preferred deductive reasoning, building on axioms to produce models of reality and incontrovertible proofs. Their aim was to explain objects or phenomena and to identify cause and effect. Opposites were independent and in contradiction to each other. In contrast, Chinese inquiry was more intuitive, drawing on analogies and seeking correlations. It was directed more at understanding processes and the relationships between objects. Contradictions were accepted and were seen as interdependent. Whilst the Chinese did deploy deduction as a form of reasoning, they tended to avoid the formulation of axioms and did not seek incontrovertible proofs. That is to say, what we see today as contrasts between Western and East Asian cognitive styles have deep historical roots. One other finding of interest was that the role of scholars in China was to support the emperor in his deliberation. Something we see enforced by today's leadership in China. In contrast, the Greek scholar was more likely to act as an individual and to propound his thinking in public. The final line of thought relates to the historical evidence for contrasting political and economic and legal cultures, and here I just focus on these cultures in China. Politics in imperial China drew principally on two traditions, Confucian and legalist. Societal norms drew heavily on the Confucian traditions of ritual, hierarchy, filial loyalty, allegiance to family and clan, and conformity. Key values included virtue and harmony between different interests. These norms and values were embodied in the emperor and in the relationship between him and the people. Despite the dominance of Confucian rhetoric, legalist principles were often deployed to ensure effective control of the country. These date back to the 4th century before the Christian era, and built on a cynical view of humanity that required a powerful ruler to exercise absolute power. Later dynasties deliberately incorporated Confucian principles into their governance narratives, resulting in what has been termed a Confucian legalist state, in which the balance between the two philosophies has fluctuated over time. The extent to which today's political culture represents continuity with the imperial past, or a truly evolutionary new era, is contentious. Even some of those who argue for a degree of continuity suggest that the Communist Party has deliberately chosen to wear the imperial mantle of governance rather than unconsciously follow political tradition. The Communist Party of today is essentially all-powerful, at least in form, dominating as it does both state and society, with no formal constraints on its power and no formal political competition. National unity and stability remain key priorities. The economy was an essential part of the emperor's agenda. Legalists argued for state control to maximize production, whilst Confucians supported markets as means to distribute goods to the people. The result was a mixed economy, with state involvement being directed at monopolizing the production and flows of what were perceived to be resources and goods of national strategic importance. And that might also be sources of state revenue. In the past, this included salt and key metals. Today, it includes energy. China's legal system has several unique features that distinguish it from other countries. The approach to law arose from amalgamation of ideas from several schools of thought, amongst which were the legalist and Confucian schools, as in the political sphere. The result was a system of lawmaking, laws, regulations, and courts that was directed at promoting and protecting the interests of the state. This philosophy contrasts sharply with the concept of rule of law as evolved in many Western nations. As a consequence, judicial processes have made little impact on the progress of the low-carbon energy transition. Court cases brought by Chinese NGOs against local grid companies for not dispatching renewable energy in contravention of the law have gone nowhere. So, what have we learned? China's energy policies over the last 40 years display a combination of pragmatism, incrementalism, internal contradiction, and ambiguity. These features are consistent with evidence from experimental psychology and ancient history that the development of Chinese and East Asian cognitive styles over the past 2,000 years or more have taken a path distinct from Western civilizations with their Greek philosophical heritage. That is not to deny a significant degree of commonality between the cognitive styles, not least due to historically recent interactions. Rather, differences do exist and may sometimes be expressed in the design of public policy. China's imperial traditions of national governance date back thousands of years and only ended officially in 1911. However, the Communist Party has adopted, consciously or unconsciously, many of the attributes of the imperial political, economic, and legal cultures. It runs a highly centralized system of administration, in principle at least, with no formal constraints on its power. As was the case with past emperors, the Communist Party's legitimacy derives from meeting the needs of the people, such as ensuring energy supply. Despite significant reform over the last 40 years or so, the current legal system retains some features from the past. Notably, in the energy sector is an almost complete absence of litigation concerning the failure of local governments and grid companies to promote the use and dispatch of renewable energy. Policy implementation continues to rely on command and control instruments. These lines of argument have important implications for public policy in general and energy policy in particular. In the case of China, we should not expect substantial changes in the way that the country is governed, especially in sectors like energy, which are seen to be strategically important. Change will be incremental, and the direction of change will be unique. The wider implications of this study are that societal culture plays a significant role in public policy in any country, though the nature and potency of these constraints imposed by culture will vary between countries. The significance of these observations is that they render even more challenging the task of transferring public policy models between countries with different cultures. Thank you.